I was raised in Bristol, educated in Bristol, taught at Bristol Cathedral School, went to university there. Currently, I'm for a long time, I've been a senior examiner at OCR, so I write GCSEs and A-levels, amongst other things. I know it's an archaeological group, so it's a bit of archaeology. I've done my time grovelling around in the mud. No pictures of me as an archaeologist, because I was the one holding the camera, but yes, I was there in the mud, in the rain, and all of that stuff. Done that, been there, done that, drunk the beer, had the fun. Anyway, moving swiftly on, we're going to be looking at the Civil War tonight, Bristol and the Civil War. Now, Bristol was a really key city during the Civil War, being the second most important city in the country. The king very quickly lost control of London. Parliament had control over London, and the king was forced out. And so Bristol became a prime target, and became a target indeed for both sides during the Civil War. In the course of the Civil War, we had the parliamentarians occupying Bristol, the royalists capturing it and then occupying it, and then the parliamentarians attacking and recapturing it. So it saw its fair share of action. So what I'll try to do tonight is run through these two different sieges of Bristol just to try to tell the story of what happened and show a little bit of what's around today to see. So starting with Charles I, where do we start with the causes of the Civil War? I'm not going to go into the causes of the Civil War because that could be a whole course of evenings. But suffice to say, Charles I, through various policies, he'd lost support of a lot of people in England and indeed created opposition or allowed an opposition to grow up against him. And when we look at Bristol, we have to look at what Bristol's position pro or anti-king was as well. So we're leaping straight up to 1643. The war has been has broken out with some fighting in 1642 and then the Battle of Edgehill in 1642. The king tried to force his way to London and was turned round at the lesser-known Battle of Turnham Green, which is perhaps more important. And after failing to get to London, the king's eyes then turned to the second city, Bristol. And so Bristol very much became a target. Oh, I don't know why I got two of those. Okay, so here's Bristol, aerial photo of Bristol taken by a very early aeroplane in about 1610, this is drawn, and it's showing Bristol on between the Frome and the Avon, and Bristol's the area just in the middle, as I'm sure you all know. And, of course, it's got the castle dominating the ground there. So Bristol, very well protected, rivers around both sides and castle, and a very strong wall around the south. The castle, of course, no longer there. I'm rabbiting. So the castle. The castle was such a successful castle that nobody had ever attacked it. And that, to me, is a sign of a really strong castle, is that nobody even tried to attack it during its history. It cropped up in the civil war between King Stephen and the Empress Matilda back in medieval times. Stephen's army approached Bristol, saw the castle, turned around and went away again. It was that powerful fortification. So it had quite a reputation, a substantial stone castle forming the heart of the defences of Bristol. And as you can see from this illustration, it was at the time of the Civil War, plenty of cannon there. So it had been modernised to an extent in that it had cannon installed. So this was known as the key defensive point of Bristol. And anyone, Bristolians would rely on the castle for defending the city, and anyone attacking the city would have to aim at getting the castle. So it's just a close-up showing the cannon. Bristol was pretty well supplied with cannon, One reason being that it's a port, so there's ships coming in and out, and ships have cannon, and so there's a supply of cannon if need be. Bristol was also a major manufacturer of gunpowder. The king had a monopoly on gunpowder, but there were cheeky traders who would make and trade gunpowder without necessarily have gone under the auspices of the king's monopoly. And we know that Bristol had several gunpowder manufacturers, some of whom had been caught by the king's officials and fined, others who carried on regardless, some who had been caught and fined and still carried on regardless. And so Bristol was an important and well-armed place, had cannon, had gunpowder, and gunpowder was in short supply with both sides in the Civil War. This is a slightly later map, after the Civil War period, and again there's the Avon and the Froom around the main part of Bristol. You see the medieval walls and where the castle had been, all built on quite quickly after the Civil War. After the Civil War was over, the citizens of Bristol were very keen to remove the castle and build on the land instead. Again, a later image, this is from Brandon Hill, a later image of Bristol looking down, and I wanted to include this one because to show how Bristol is in a dip. I'm sure, as you all know, as Bristolians, Bristol is in a dip. It's surrounded by hills, the reason, of course, why it never snows in Bristol. Pause for dramatic effect. It doesn't snow in Bristol as often as it snows elsewhere, does it? Because it snow tends to get caught on the hills before it gets to Bristol. And certainly the centre of Bristol is down in a dip. So this view from Brandon Hill, we're looking down at the Cathedral, College Green, and the two rivers here, the centre of Bristol over here. And I draw your attention to this line here and this line here, which should have, I know it's gone slightly blurry, but what we've got here, you can see lines of ship's masts. So that's along the Froom, and that's along the Avon at the back. So just shows the sort of number of ships that could be coming in and out of Bristol at any time. Of course, that's the key to Bristol's prosperity and Bristol's wealth. Bristol was full of merchants and traders and manufacturers and the ships coming in and out. And so, of course, it's a prime city. If for any war effort, you need this manufacturing city and the trade routes and the access to transport, really important. So it became an important target for both sides. When sides were drawn, I think it's reasonable to say that when the Civil War broke out, nobody actually wanted there to be any fighting, and England reluctantly slid into civil war, and people were drawn into one side or the other by accident of birth or geography or status or religion, and to actually get to the stage where one man is prepared to fight and kill another man is a difficult process to get to, and they're ordinary human beings back then. They're just like us, all different clothes and ate different food, but otherwise they're like us. Nobody wanted to start fighting, and Bristol is a really nice example of how nobody wanted to start fighting. Some areas of Britain, some social groups, some religious groups did, if you like, naturally fall into sides at the beginning of the Civil War. So Puritans tended to support Parliament, Catholics tended to support the King, whatever. But most people wanted to keep out of it as they could. And Bristol also wanted to stay out of it. Bristol had done its very best to remain out of the argument between the King and Parliament from when it had started. And the Bristol Bristolians, there were some who were pro-King, there were some who were pro-Parliament. There was doubtless some arguments in pubs in Bristol. But on the whole, Bristol retained its, I won't even say neutrality, it just didn't, it cleverly manoeuvred itself to not actually join either side. But as it became more of a target for both Parliament and the King, both Parliament and the King wanted they could write to Bristol, the city of Bristol, and say, can we rely on your loyalty? And of course the City Council would write back saying, yes, we're entirely loyal to insert side here. both the King and Parliament suggested sending troops to garrison Bristol. But the Bristol City Council said, no, that's fine, thanks, very generous offer, but we're fine, we've got our own militia, we don't need any troops sent here to garrison us, thanks a lot. And so Bristol had managed to remain not linked to either side. And then both the King and Parliament began to sort of race to get troops into Bristol. And it was Parliament who won the race, and their commanding officer was the Earl of Essex over here. And he arrived at the gates of Bristol in late 1642 with some parliamentarian troops. One gate of Bristol, the Frome Gate, was defended by a group of armed sailors who were trying to stop him from coming in. Essex heard about this, so simply went into Bristol via another gate. So there wasn't much opposition to him, but the Bristolians were aware if they resisted, then they would be attacked. And so the Bristolians, oh no, welcome in, do come in. And we have gifts from the council to Essex and his officers. Essex is quite quickly replaced by Nathaniel Fiennes over here on the right. Essex was deemed as not trustworthy by the parliamentarians. He was hobnobbing with royalists. He was having dinner with known royalists in Bristol. He shot one of his own men dead. When one of his men asked for his back pay, he drew out a pistol and shot him dead on the spot, and which didn't go down very well with the rest of his soldiers. So Parliament replaced him with Nathaniel Fiennes. And Nathaniel Fiennes, poor chap, he had a bit of a checkered career, as was he. So Nathaniel Fiennes takes over as the commander of Bristol. And he immediately starts looking to its defence. He's moved into Bristol with a small parliamentarian force. He knows that the royalists will be on their way at some point to attack Bristol. So he has to start looking into its defence. Of course, as I've said, there's the castle at the centre of Bristol. But, as I've also said, Bristol, centre of Bristol, is in a dip. And Nathaniel Fiennes, I've just got these two plans up here, trying to show the land around. There's this central area of Bristol, castle over here. And you can see different hills, Brandon Hill, where the university is, Priors Hill, and then round to M32, Old Market. And Redcliffe down here, and again showing the hills, the landscape over here, you can see the hills. So Nathaniel Fiennes arrived in Bristol and looked at the castle. Yes, very strong, very well protected, but in a dip, therefore below where people could fire cannons at it, so actually totally useless. And even though the Bristolians had depended on the defence of the city from the castle, Fiennes realised very quickly the castle was useless. You had to build defences in a big circuit around Bristol. So he started work on a defensive line around to the north. The south was okay because there's still a big strong medieval wall around Redcliffe. But Fiennes started building a wall all the way around, quite a way out from Bristol, on the tops of the hills. His soldiers were involved. The population of Bristol were involved. People were forced out from their homes in Bristol to dig a ditch, build a wall and a palisade, build forts on tops of the hills, and all against the clock, because Bristol had now become a target and the royalists were aiming for Bristol. They were aiming for Bristol from two directions, from the north and from the south. This is just another later image, but showing Bristol Cathedral in the centre of Bristol here, and just showing the hills around there with the Downs, Brandon Hill, University, just to show, just to emphasise the hilly terrain. The Royalists were officially under the command of the Marquess of Hertford, but they were actually under the command of Prince Rupert, who was King Charles's nephew. He was one of the very, very few Royalists, and indeed one of the very few men in England who had any military experience at all. Parliament had a handful of men who had served in the 30 Years' War, but the Royalists had very few. But Rupert was one who had got military experience. dashing-looking chap. He'd been active in the 30 Years' War, been quite a successful general, and he had quite a reputation for military efficiency. Him and his uncle, the king, had planned a two-pronged attack on Bristol, actually combining three different field armies, two moving in from the north and one moving in from the south, and they were going to all hit Bristol at the same time. Nathaniel Fiennes was aware that the Royalists were heading towards Bristol, and he was working feverishly to build his defences around the town. Prince Rupert arrived from the north with the King's Oxford army, his best troops, and Rupert stopped at the village of Westbury-on-Trim outside Bristol, and he stayed here in the college, and made this his HQ for while he was there. The parliamentarians, of course, were aware that the Royalists were closing in from the north and south, and to add to Nathaniel Fiennes' woes, a portion of his garrison had been drawn out to be lent to the parliamentarian field army, which had just recently been substantially defeated at the Battle of Roundway Down. So Nathaniel Fiennes had lost some of his soldiers who he had lent out and who never came back. It's so difficult working out the numbers of soldiers involved on either of the armies for either of the sieges, but we could work at something around, let's say, 3,000 Royalists and 1,500 parliamentarians in the city, something-ish, and it's about the same, but the other way around, when the parliamentarians attack. Nathaniel Fiennes wrote an account of what happened in this siege, and he downplayed the number of soldiers he had on purpose, because he was forced to surrender. He was accused of surrendering too quickly, so he wanted to blame everybody else. So he said, we can't trust how many soldiers he says he had. Anyway, so there's Rupert, and an actual photograph of Rupert here. there he is in Westbury-on-Trim, and with his dog, Boy, who accompanied him on campaign. And Boy became quite a thing with the parliamentarians, that there were some more of the puritanical parliamentarians who thought that Boy was somehow some sort of devilish beast. So when Boy was killed at the Battle of Master Moor, he was stuck on the end of a pike and paraded around in front of the parliamentarian troops. But that's a spoiler. I shouldn't have said that bit. Rupert and his dog. Rupert was in Westbury-on-Trim. And in order to show that he meant business, he ordered his troops to burn down Westbury-on-Trim. So that's why not much of the old village of Westbury-on-Trim is still there. There's a couple of streets, but the rest of it is gone. He did this in order to make a point to the Bristolians. They would see the smoke coming up over the horizon from the downs. They would know what it meant, and they would know he means business. They know he's tough. He's not mucking about. And Bristolians were ordinary people, like we are. They lived in houses with their families. They didn't want to lose their houses, families, property, possessions, jobs. Didn't want to lose any of that. So if there's somebody coming who's burning everything down, then Rupert would hope that would make them want to surrender nice and quickly, out of terror. It certainly terrified the Bristolians. Rupert had this growing reputation as a destroyer of property. Anyway. With Rupert was a Dutch engineer, a chap called Bernard de Gom, and he was an expert in fortifications, and he accompanied Rupert on campaign to advise him. This is a later portrait of him, hence the later fashion. And I've also included a picture of the gatehouse of the Plymouth Citadel, because this was part of Bernard de Gom's later works. He did various building defensive works across England, substantial and ornate. But we've got Bernard de Gom's account of the first siege of Bristol, and he tells us, we've got his point of view, his version of what happened. We know that Rupert and Bernard de Gom went somewhere onto the Downs, where they looked down at Bristol using their newfangled telescopes. And so I like to think it's somewhere around here, the view down Sutherland Place, just off the edge of the Downs, behind the coach and horses. It's difficult to get a view from the Downs down to Bristol now, because there's so many buildings or trees. But this is one of the very few places you can still see, you can see down into Bristol from the Downs. So next time you're going for a walk on the Downs, go to the top of Sutherland Place and imagine the ghost of Rupert is next to you with a little dog running around. So they were looking at down at the defences to see how they could attack the city. They were surveying the different forts that Fiennes had built. They were surveying with their telescopes the defences that had been built. And they could see the defences were unfinished. Fiennes had been trying to dig a substantial ditch, and then the spoil from that would be a bank, and then on top of the bank would be a palisade. But in places the ditch wasn't very deep, where it was directly into rock, it's of course very difficult to dig, and the Bristolians had been slower digging there than where it was just earth. And so the ditch wasn't complete, the bank wasn't complete. And we've also got a massively long defensive work running all the way around Bristol. It's a huge length of defensive line. And Rupert and Bernard de Gom were looking for weak points where they thought it would be sensible to attack. They had an army coming from the north, from the Downs, basically, and an army coming from the south, towards Redcliffe, and they wanted to coincide the attack going ahead. They, first of all, of course, they'd summon Bristol to surrender. Until quite recently, you summon a town to surrender. If they surrender immediately, then they get good terms. They can keep their possessions. Their soldiers can march out with their weapons, whatever. If a town refuses that summons and resists, then they get less good terms if they surrender later. If they don't surrender at all, but the city is actually broken into, they can expect everything to be destroyed and maybe no prisoners taken. So it's a sort of gamble as to how long you hold out. The longer you hold out, the worse it will be for you when you do surrender. And that's absolutely key. We've got Nathaniel Fiennes defending the city, and every minute of the royalist attack he has to consider, should I throw in the towel now and save some stuff, or should I risk carrying on fighting? Anyway, fighting hasn't started yet. I just put this one in. It's the top of Cabot Tower, but it's again looking down, just to show how you look down into the centre of Bristol there. And the other landmark I always like pointing out is this one, the Beacon Tower. Until recently, the Colston Tower. It's more or less on the site of, and more or less exactly the same height as, the tower of the Carmelite Monastery that had been there. Anyway, that's a different talk. Just one of my... I like that little factoid. Anyway, so there's Bristol, yet another map of Bristol, and this one showing the dispositions. We've got the defences running around. Nathaniel finds his ring of defences, a wall around Redcliffe, and the river, of course, protecting Bristol here. And this marks some royalist blocks of royalist soldiers coming in from the north and from the south. Again, it's showing the hills, so you can see how the hills are important. Now, it seems that Rupert and de Gaume's tactic was to, or strategy, was to capture the hills, or at least one of the hills, from whence their cannon could command the city. So if they could take one of the hills, they could put their artillery there, and then the artillery could just start firing down into the city, and the city would just have to capitulate, because there's nothing they could do. Interestingly, when... Oops, I have to go back. When Parliament attacked, there's also emphasis on this area. Anyway, I'm jumping the gun. So there's Bristol, down in the dip, and the town of Redcliffe there next to it, surrounded by a wall. And got some royalists coming up here. And there's the wall. There's a better map of where the wall is. This is from that amazing publication, that map you can buy of Bristol in 1480, which is... I've almost worn mine out. It's great.
Is that William Wordsworth's map?
No, it's the one Bob Jones put together. But it's based on William Wordsworth.
Yes.
So we can see the substantial medieval wall that was there, had been built in the medieval period, and was still there in the 17th century. And a number of gates, a couple of gates, a number of bastions and towers, a strong position. Nothing left of it today, except the line of these buildings, and the Port Wall Tavern is still flying the flag, saying, yes, this is where the port wall was. So opposite St Mary Redcliffe, of course. So next time you're down in that area, you can sort of trace the line of the medieval wall just because of the street line. So the Port Wall Tavern, sadly, all that remains of the substantial port wall. We know it's substantial because nobody ever attacked it in the medieval period, and it was attacked twice in the 17th century, and nobody broke into it in either of those attacks. When Rupert's army attacked from the north, the Royalist army attacked from the south at the same time. Many of the men in the Royalist army attacking here were raised in Cornwall, and they didn't even speak English, they were Cornish speakers. The three assault columns that attacked the port wall, all three of them lost their commanding officers and their second-in-commands. So it shows there's some pretty tough fighting going on. But these Cornish still failed to get to breach the wall at all. And the same happened when Parliament tried to attack a couple of years later. So no success there. Okay, so meanwhile, back on the north, I'm going to run round some of the defences on the north as I tell the tale of what's going on. This not very exciting photograph is from Brandon Hill, and I can assure you when you're there and standing on it, it's really exciting because you can see the triangular shape of a 17th century gun emplacement, and you can see the ditch in front of it. There would have been a cannon here pointing that way towards Clifton, so when you're actually there, it's great, but in a photo like that, it's not very impressive. Sadly, the Victorians planted a tree on it, so I think any archaeology has pretty much been mushed up by that. And Bristol City Council, of course, they mark it with a sign about their nature reserve there. As you'll see in my talk this evening, I'm slightly interested in the signage of these things. Personally, I think it's a missed opportunity. We've got some great Civil War defences on Brandon Hill, but there's no sign. There's a sign about butterflies, which are lovely, but, you know, come on, there's an opportunity. An opportunity missed, I think. On the top of Brandon Hill was a small fort. This James Russell picture is actually of the later fort. The fort that was on Brandon Hill when the Royalists attacked was... a rather minuscule 18 feet square, which sort of seems an unlikely size for a fort, but that's how the royalists measured it, and so you've got this tiny fort on the top of Brandon Hill, and this tiny fort on the top of Brandon Hill fought very well. The royalists came across from Clifton down the dip to what is now Jacob's Wells Road and QEH, and coming up the Brandon Hill from there, found themselves under fire from this fort and sustaining casualties from them, and had to move away. But I'm leaping ahead. Let's go take our mind back to Rupert and Bernard de Gaume being on the downs with their telescopes. You can imagine the scene, a group of a dozen horsemen in their finery on the edge of the downs with their fancy telescopes, looking across at this fort at Brandon Hill to and making notes of the defences and the number of cannon and soldiers here or whatever, and discussing where they should attack or not. While Rupert and Bernard de Gaume and his little group of staff were on the downs, we have what's possibly the first bloodshed of the attack, of the first siege of Bristol. There was a parliamentarian who was, Bernard de Gaume describes him as vapouring in his shirt, and I've no idea what vapouring in his shirt means. I just are working backwards on this. If he's in his shirt, I'm thinking, well, he's not wearing a jacket. Okay, so he's wearing a shirt. Vapouring in his shirt, I don't know. I wonder if that's something to do with air or something. So I reached the conclusion that this is possibly a parliamentarian who's standing on the wall of the little fortlet, who can see these posh royalists over on the downs, looking at them through their telescopes. And I wonder whether this is someone who he's just wearing his shirt, which of course, like a nightdress almost, shirt, 17th century shirts are very long. I wonder whether he lifted his shirt as a mark of disrespect to these royalists at Clifton. But whatever, he was cut in half by a cannonball, so that taught him a lesson. He won't do that again. So possibly, certainly one of the earliest casualties of the siege of Bristol. This little fort was commanded by an unknown, then unknown, artillery officer from Bridgewater called Robert Blake. And, of course, it's a reasonable position of responsibility, being in command of a fort and the defensive line of Bristol. But it's only a small fort, so he's only got one or two small guns and a handful of soldiers there. But he fought very well in the first siege of Bristol, so well that he almost lost his life, because when Bristol surrendered, nobody told Blake in his little fort that Bristol had surrendered. And so his soldiers carried on fighting, which, of course, is a no-no. If you've got soldiers who have surrendered, they mustn't then carry on fighting. Blake narrowly missed the whole lot, all of his garrison just being lined up against the wall and being shot. But he survived, which is lucky, because he went on to become quite famous. His artillery skills led him to becoming promoted in the Parliamentarian army, and Cromwell later promoted him to general at sea. The Parliamentarians believed that you didn't need admirals at sea, you needed generals, because boats are really floating artillery platforms. So what you need in command of a ship is not some sailor, you need someone who knows how to operate artillery. So Robert Blake ended up in command of the English fleet during the Protectorate under Cromwell, and led it to various huge victories over the Dutch in the First Dutch War, and also less well known against the Barbary Corsairs, these pirates of North Africa who have been stealing white Christian women and selling them as slaves, and they were a scourge of the West Country in particular, where they would just land. They used Lundy as a base at one point, and they would land and steal people and sell them into slavery. And they were a scourge of all Mediterranean countries and Britain. But it was Robert Blake who took the English fleet into the harbour of the Barbary Corsairs and just smashed it. But that's another story.
Did he capture Jamaica?
No, I don't think... gosh, you put me on the spot there.
It was taken in Cromwell's time.
Yes, it was, yeah, certainly. Yeah, they'd accidentally captured it, yeah. Because they were after another island, but they got that one instead. I've just got this. This is in the cathedral. This is one of the windows in the cathedral, and it shows our British naval heroes, and, of course, is Nelson, Drake, Raleigh, but Blake as well. You know, he's right up there, but sadly, nobody knows about him anymore, so that's why he's getting a little extra mention tonight, because I think he deserves it. Moving up, this is where Blake was defending. Top of Brandon Hill was a little fort. I've visited this site many times over the years and seen it in various states of repair and disrepair. And this is a photo I took of it some years ago, where you can't see the ditch and you can't see the wall. There's another photo I took years ago where you can just see the wall, but it's all a bit overgrown. Another one where you can see the wall. And this one, not all that long ago, where the wall was, you can see it falling down into this ditch, and the wall being demolished by the undergrowth. So imagine my delight when, more recently, it's been cleared. Hooray! And a lot of the undergrowth is gone and the wall's been cleared of stuff. Doubtless it'll all grow back again, but it's nice at the moment. Now, what we've got here at the top of Brandon Hill is... it's not so clear from the photo, but when you're standing there, you've got a really convincing V-shaped ditch. Really nice, a pointy shape of the fort. Substantial stonework going all around. And for a long time, it was thought that this was the fort at the top of Brandon Hill. Not the little parliamentarian one, but a more substantial one that the royalists built later. It was fairly recently excavated, and yes, there's the defensive ditch. Fantastic. All is, you know, as we've hoped for. But slightly disappointingly, when they were looking at the wall itself, they came to the conclusion that it's not a 17th century defensive work. It's actually an 18th century or late 17th century folly. I'm still not 100% convinced on that, because it's why build a folly that looks like a modern fort? If you're going to build a folly, you make it look like a medieval castle or something. But anyway. So that's the current theory. And what we all know and love about studying history is that it changes all the time. You get a new discovery and it all changes. Unlike maths, you know, 2 plus 2 is always going to equal 4, isn't it? But in history, things change. New discovery. So currently, it's not a fort. It's a folly. But there we are. Top of Brandon Hill again, there's a nice bench there now. There was, until fairly recently, a cannon, which is captured at Sebastopol. Very distinctive type of cannon, this that the British captured in the Crimean War. I just like that image of the children sitting on the cannon. Cannon, of course, vanished in the First World War to be melted down. View from Cabot Tower again, but looking down from Brandon Hill, you can see how Brandon Hill commands the river. So nobody coming in or out of Bristol could pass Brandon Hill without permission. And even more effectively, down at the bottom, somewhere in the trees here, was another little fort, the water fort, which had guns directly pointing at the river. So whoever controlled Brandon Hill controlled access in and out of Bristol. So a diagram just showing the Royalist attack. We've got Royalists attacking from the north, and the Cornish attacking from the south and failing to get in, and the parliamentarians still with their castle here and their medieval walls and defences all sitting comfortably in there, but this wall all around here under pressure. Royalists were trying to get to Brandon Hill. They were under fire, so they moved down the hill. They came under fire from the next fort up here, Windmill Hill Fort, which is where the university is now. And it was around here, which is top of Park Street, basically, effectively. Top of Park Street, where the Royalists had been coming down the hill here to avoid the fire from Brandon Hill and to avoid the fire from Windmill Hill. They headed down the hill, and once they got to the bottom, they realised that they weren't getting hit by cannonballs. The cannonballs were flying over their heads, and they were in a blind spot. And so the Royalist soldiers sort of gravitated to this blind spot, and once there, realised that the defence they were facing was just a very shallow ditch, a very low bank, and not much of a defence at all. And so Colonel Washington led his troops across this low wall, this shallow ditch and low wall, and breached the defences. But Nathaniel Fiennes was prepared for this sort of thing. He had mobile units of troops ready to plug gaps that appeared in the wall, and a unit of cavalry appeared to push back Colonel Washington's force. Colonel Washington's force were able to push back the cavalry. We're told they used fire pikes to frighten the horses, which is presumably burning rags around the end of the 18-foot-long pikes. Or it might be something a bit more elaborate than that. But so this parliamentarian counterattack failed. They came along Park Row and were pushed back again. Park Street didn't exist then. It was just a slope going down towards College Green. Some of the Royalists headed down that slope towards College Green, where they came under fire from parliamentarian musketeers in the cathedral. And so a musketry duel started down on College Green. So this is just showing where the Washington's breach was, and some soldiers going down onto College Green, the others pushing along Park Row. Still haven't got into the main part of Bristol at all, down here. So this is the dip today that they went down to the top of Park Street. And the spot is marked by another plaque, this one says how Colonel Henry Washington led his troops in, and he was the grandson of Lawrence Washington, an ancestor of George Washington, President of the United States. So there is some notice there. This is just near the outside of the museum these days. I quite like the fact that this plaque was put there by the Bristol branch of the Geographical Association. What are they doing? We historians don't go around marking geographical things with history plaques. So damn cheeky, if you ask me, these geographers going around and marking history things. They should mind their own business and stick to their rocks and maps. Anyway, so that's another missed opportunity. Where's the sign from the council saying this is an important spot?
We left it to the historian. Oh, yeah. And
he
never
had. No, too busy reading books. Yeah. Quite right. But Wetherspoons marks it.
Yes.
In the Barclay Wetherspoon says that they've got some information about it. So that's good. So there's your excuse to go and have a pint. So top of Park Street, this is more or less where Colonel Washington broke in, with some of his troops going straight on down Park Row, some of them heading down the slope towards College Green. Of course, archaeologically, you're going to have trouble finding anything here if you were able to dig this up, which is not going to happen. But there's no archaeology left there, I wouldn't have thought. But again, the parliamentarians had a second line of defence, even though they'd had their cavalry, but they also had a second line of defence, which was a fort, a little fort just down here somewhere, which was very neatly uncovered when the university built these buildings. The parliamentarian soldiers there, when they saw the Royalists heading down Park Row towards them, they very sensibly got up, dropped their weapons and ran away. So the Royalists were able to move along Park Row. They carried on along Park Row until they got to St Michael's Hill, which is the road down into Bristol, and headed down St Michael's Hill, down Christmas Steps, towards the gates of Bristol. And Christmas Steps today is small and crammed, but imagine that with hundreds of royalist soldiers piling down here, under fire from parliamentarian musketeers leaning out of the windows. It must have been a chaotic, bloody and horrific time. And there's a plaque there as well, and one of the royalist colonels was shot in the heart there and killed, it's a sealed notch. We put this one up, so hooray to them. So it's a little difficult to spot it now, the plaque, but it is still there. Coming out at the bottom of Christmas Steps, they reached the Froome Gate, which is about where the, well, somewhere around here, there had been a gate. Leading to a bridge across to the gateway into Bristol here. At the Froome Gate, which was closed and defended by a small group of parliamentarian soldiers, the parliamentarian soldiers then found themselves accompanied by a group of Bristol women led by Mrs. Dorothy Hazard, who she arrived with a group of women saying, "How can we help? How can we help keep the royalists out?" And the soldiers said, "Well, there's nothing you can do. You might as well go, you know." And she said, "No, we could stand in front of you to catch the bullets." And the soldiers thought it might be more useful if they carried some bales of stuff and piled them up against the gates. So they did that. So they were piling up stuff against the gates. Not one single royalist had got into Bristol. And it was at that point that Nathaniel Fiennes surrendered. And he came under a lot of trouble from Parliament for doing this, surrendering so quickly, when not a single royalist had actually got into Bristol. He claimed that Bristol was indefensible, that he didn't have enough soldiers, and he claimed that by surrendering quickly, he was able to leave with his surviving soldiers. And he agreed articles of surrender with Rupert, and they left. 5 minutes and I'll stop. Rupert now took over Bristol, and the first thing he did was to start to rebuild the defences, because it was now a target for Parliament to attack. And he had his military engineer with him. This is, you can't see the sign, but it's the Royal Fort at the top of where the university is. The Royal Fort that he built isn't there anymore. It was totally demolished after the war, but he built on the top of the hill a state-of-the-art fort, which is nicely signposted today. This is the Royal Fort Garden. That's a sign for it. I just think it amused me that it says no dogs. You think, oh, what would Rupert have done? I don't need to do that. I'm just saying where we've got a near contemporary illustration of it in the margins of this slightly later map, which is quite useful if you're trying to work out where it used to be. And it's been excavated a couple of times, different bits of it. So the plan shown here does tally really quite nicely with what we know is there now. It was convincingly demolished, and with a vengeance it was demolished. Except for one bit. And I can't help thinking that they did that on purpose. Why leave that bit of wall in the middle of your garden? I think it's every other trace of the Royal Fort has gone, was demolished after the war. But I think that's just done as a little reminder, you know, just a sobering reminder of what the place had been. And we've got, this is Humphrey Repson, and when he was re-landscaping the area, he very usefully actually showed us where the ditch was when he was re-landscaping the hill. Anyway, the gateway survives, it's still there, and with the brickwork. And when I was taken there by an archaeology professor at university some years ago, and he went on about the brickwork there, saying how modern that was for Prince Rupert to have used that, and how amazing it was. We can go under there, look at the ceiling, and think, that's Prince Rupert saw that. But nowadays, the current theory is that it's later. Damn. So that lovely story has vanished in a puff of smoke. But it's not much later, and it's the gatehouse is on the in the right place. Again, nicely signposted by the local improvement society. Okay, very quickly, 1 minute. 1645, Cromwell and the Earl of Essex are now heading to Bristol. This is where they stayed, in Stapleton, and marked with a nice plaque. And there's a photo inside. I even found a photo of what it's like inside. So that's probably the very table they set out to have their tea. Anyway. Now, Cromwell and Essex had, having seen Bristol fall to the Royalists before, they worked out quite a convincing strategy to deal with Bristol this time. Started with them capturing the fort at Porter's Head. Now, it's only a little fort, but it's on this promontory here, and so it commanded the King's Road, the access to Bristol by sea. So Parliament was insistent on getting that, because once they got that, they cut Bristol off by sea. They were faced with the same problem that Rupert had been faced with, of the long defences, and they aimed for that one, Prior's Hill Fort, and that's where they headed. So they ignored the Royal Fort, they ignored Brandon Hill. They made some progress coming in down Old Market, but their main attack was at Prior's Hill Fort, which looked like that at those dates. And they got in by climbing in through the gun ports. And the fort then fell. And just like Nathaniel Fiennes had surrendered quickly, Prince Rupert then surrendered. And he was... Because Fiennes had got in trouble for surrendering Bristol too quickly. Rupert got in trouble for surrendering Bristol too quickly. His uncle was angry with him, so he stormed off, didn't have any more to do with the Civil War. Or he sort of did. He became technically a pirate. He was set up in Lundy, attacking parliamentarian ships. He then went off to the West Indies, doing piratey things. He ended up then in France, doing science. He was very keen on science. He became a scientist in his later years. Then King gets his head chopped off, and that's the end of it all, really. And that's as far as I want to go. So apologies for overrunning slightly, but that's my little brief presentation of the two sieges of Bristol.
Idea that Prince Rupert served as an admiral after the Restoration, or maybe I've...
No, you're right. Yeah.
And I think possibly along with Blake. I'm not sure on that one.
No, I think Blake was dead by then.
Blake was dead by then, but Rupert... Yeah. Well, that was... splendid stuff, and I should say that if your appetites have been whetted, and I hope they have, that Richard does a number of historical walks, including one which I've been on, all up around Brandon Hill, and eventually down Christmas Steps. And also lectures on the Stuart era generally at adult education lectures in Stoke Lodge, and bats all round the wicket because he's also an authority on warfare in the ancient world. I haven't officially asked you this, Richard. I think I know the answer. I hope I know the answer. Will you take a few questions?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Unless people want to escape, seeing that I've overrun. Sir.
Sorry, I'd like to see the third last photograph of the Prince Rupert. I'd like to read it. Where is that exactly?
I've put away my little jigger for controlling the thing. Fremantle Square.
What was the effective range of cannon at that time?
Well, it varied depending on the size.
From Sutherland Place, they could have killed somebody on Bandon Hill.
Yeah, it depends on depends on the size of the cannon, of course. But certainly from Clifton Downs, they'd be able to hit Brandon Hill. Yeah, right. And from Brandon Hill, being able to hit Bristol easily with a larger cannon. Yeah.
Well, one shield with 12-18 pounders, nothing bigger.
Did I show any cannon?
You did, a couple of them. Yeah, girls sitting on one.
Oh, that's a Russian one from the Victorian period. Yeah, that's from Sebastopol. Yeah.
But the drawings of one sticking out the walls.
Yeah.
They've probably been 12 pounders.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. They do vary a lot.
Quite a lot of the fortifications around the country after the Civil War were destroyed by Cromwell, hoping that the Royalists couldn't regroup or anything. So was that the fate of the castle? I don't know, it might fall outside the scope of your thoughts.
No, absolutely. Cromwell wanted to slight the castle, he wanted to damage it, but the Bristolians themselves were very keen to remove it, and they were asking, can we please get rid of it? Because it wasn't technically part of Bristol, because it was royal land. So it had always been legally a problem that it's right in the centre of Bristol, was on this prime land, was this bit of land that they didn't even own, that somebody else owned. It was under somebody else's jurisdiction. So Bristolians were very keen to demolish it, sell the stone, build stuff. Yeah. Do you have a question?
How confident are you about the route of the defences on the eastern side of the town?
Not as much, because there's been so much roadworks over there with Old Market and the M32 and things that it's much more difficult to trace. It's traceable, but not on a map rather than on foot, if that makes sense. So there's nothing, you can't walk them. You can walk the western side and the southern side and the northern side, but the eastern side you can't. There's no physical trace left of it. It's all roads. Yeah.
Paul, when the gentleman behind you.
It may be an urban myth, but what I've read is that Cromwell said the Bristolians could remove the castle, and nothing happened for about 6 months until they said they would pay them. And then it came down in 2 weeks.
All right.
That sounds right.
Have you heard that?
I don't know that one, but it's.
Fitting with them being traders and merchants.
Absolutely, the money would have been absolutely all the way through the Civil War period. Bristol's relationship, the money that is spent on the different people who've come in, the occupiers suddenly find gifts given to them by Bristol City Council, and there's sort of mysterious gaps in the minute books, and you know, because nobody wants to. But money was very important.
If they had all these forts on the high, sort of high ground, was there a thought of coming up the river beyond the high ground and landing sort of in between Bristol and the high ground?
It's tidal. You can't. That's why Bristol is where it is. By the time you've come up the river, the tide's gone out again and you're stuck.
You'd be in.
Well, you'd be in and the tide would have gone out. So, you know, you'd be faced with 100 yards of mud. So the short answer is no. It's just the practicalities make it impossible.
Just to say, to build that protected ditch and the wall must have been quite a feat.
Yeah.
How long did that take to do? How long did they have notice that they ought to do that? And how many men were actually involved in doing that? Because it's quite a job.
I'm looking at about 4 or 5 months. And no way of working out how many people were involved.
There must have been hundreds.
We know people were just rounded up from Bristol to forced to go up and do it. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have a question in terms of West Brom Trim College.
Yeah.
Was that destroyed as part of Rupert's sort of burning, or...? Was that a bit later?
Later on. Yeah. It survived because Rupert didn't burn it down. Much of the area around it was burnt down, but he didn't burn down his own headquarters.
Yeah.
But it's just been knocked about since then, really, by various you know, additions and conversions and things.
What are you basing that on, and what was third and fourth?
Well, Norwich would be the third one, probably. Bristol, for the amount of trade coming in and out of it, was definitely number two after London. And it's not on the par with London, but it's definitely the second most important. It's not nearly as rich, but it's definitely the second most important one because of the trade. It's a rich city.
Well, if there are no more questions at the end of a fascinating evening, I'd like to ask Alan Clark to come up and deliver a vote of thanks.
Yes, thank you, Richard, and all of us for a really informative and enjoyable talk. I was on your side from the beginning because it's really always a great pleasure to see that fantastic triple portrait of Charles I by Van Dyck. And I was really pleased to hear about Robert Blake, because quite recently I spent some time in Santa Cruz de Tenerife, where Blake had managed to destroy the Spanish fleet and seize their treasure. And I was visiting some of the forts that were trying to resist his attack in 1657. They did a much more successful job when Nelson tried to attack them 140 years later. Thanks for that. So, an excellent conclusion to our season, I think. Lovely humour, range of sources, and particularly the combination of photographs and maps so that we could really visualise the events of the sieges and in between them. So many thanks on behalf of all of us.
Yeah.